A Palm Sunday Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 28, 1999, in the series God in the Mirror of a Human Face, entitled Jerusalem and Jesus, Deja Vu Forever. The texts for the sermon are Zechariah 9, verses 9 through 19, and Luke 19, verses 28 through 48. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
The story that Luke paints of Jesus is written some 50 years after the events. And of course, it didn't take one who could predict the future to utter the words that Jesus predicted, although Luke writes them after the fact. It's his understanding of Jesus, how Jesus approached the city for that final time, standing over the city, looking at it, and weeping, because he saw the inevitable devastation that would come in light of the intransigence, of the injustice, and the violence in the human heart. In the middle of his gospel, Luke had Jesus move out of the Galilean ministry, set his face steadfastly to Jerusalem. And on Palm Sunday, we celebrate his coming to that city. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke only one visit to Jerusalem, this one. This entrance into the city and into the heart of the city, into the temple, to make his non-violent protest against the whole structured, established way of things, religious, political, and economic. We have been seeking to get the contours of the historical Jesus right, because the God that we worship, we claim to be mirrored in the face of Jesus. And the God that we worship will shape our lives. The image of God that we carry around with us will determine our character, our nature. And thus, if Jesus mirrors the heart of God, then we must get Jesus right. In order to get God right, in order to be right. And as he stands looking at the holy city, with tears flowing down his cheeks, he says, "If only you had known the things that make for peace, but now they are hid from your eyes." And he goes on to describe, although Luke certainly is describing after the fact, the facts as they actually happened. For it was some 40 years after Jesus that the city of Jerusalem was reduced to rubble, the temple smoldering ruins. The Roman violence elicited the Jewish violence that elicited even greater Roman violence. And Jerusalem ceased to be the holy city, crowned with a temple, the center of Jewish life. That is always the way it is, where violence reigns. And as that ancient philosopher Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again. Jesus and Jerusalem, will it always be so? Will violence always beget violence? Injustice elicit violent reaction, eliciting even more violence? Is there no hope for the human situation? That is a question that Philip Holley raised in his own life in the 70s. He was raised a Jewish boy, and in his childhood knew his face smashed simply because he was a Jew. He became a U.S. soldier in World War II and fired 155-millimeter shells that decimated the German troops, and he saw the butchered bodies as he walked by. He became a philosopher, an ethicist, studying good and evil. In the 70s, he was doing research in the documents of the Holocaust, and he felt suddenly overwhelmed with darkness and with evil. He said to himself, if this is the way life is, the burden is too heavy to bear. He said, what would I tell my children? What lies will I have to tell my children to give them any hope, which they need as plants need the sun? Philip Haley said, I was on the point of suffering from the coercion of despair. And in the midst of his research, he came across a notice about a little French village in the south of France, Le Chabon. It was a little village that had a French Reformed church, a French Huguenot pastor named André Trocmé. And under the spiritual guidance of Trocmé, the village became a city of refuge for many Jews and other marginalized people during the 4 years, 1940 to 1944. André Trocmé was a young man growing up in northern France near the Belgian border during the First World War. He was a person of wealth and privilege. At age 17, as the Germans were retreating in that First World War, he had come to hate them, even though his mother was German, and even though he could speak German fluently, because he had seen them abusing Russian prisoners that they were using as slave labor. He was walking down the road and saw wounded German soldiers coming to him, one being led by two others, one on either side, his head all bandaged, his jaw had been blown off. He was a frightful sight. And Trocmé, as a young man of 17, looked at him and suddenly knew that he could not hate Germans. He could not hate this man. This was a human being. And something began to work in him. Shortly after, he encountered another German soldier, a man named Kindler, who offered him some bread. And he said, I won't take your bread even if I was hungry. You are the enemy. And the German soldier said, I'm not your enemy. He said, I am a Christian. I carry no weapon. I will shoot no one. And it evolved into a relationship. And out of all of that, the young Trocmé became a convinced pacifist and believed absolutely in the nonviolence of Jesus. He wrote, if Jesus really walked upon this earth, why do we keep treating him as if he were a disembodied, impossibly idealistic ethical theory? If he was a real man, then the Sermon on the Mount was made for people on this earth. And if he existed, God has shown us in flesh and blood what goodness is for flesh and blood people. Trocmé was absolutely conquered by that vision. He was a person of means and privilege. He came to this country, he had a fine education, studied at the University of Paris, followed theology, eventually became the French Huguenot pastor in Le Chabon as Hitler was heating things up on the continent. And as the French were overrun by the Nazi regime, and the French provisional government, the Vichy government, came to power. France itself was Nazified in order to pacify the Gestapo of Hitler. André Trocmé, having been convinced of the nonviolence of Jesus, had begun to model his life on the determination to do no harm. He was a powerful man. He was like a volcano ready to explode. And yet, this powerful, restless spirit felt totally committed to a way of nonviolent resistance. He led his parish and his village to become an oasis of safety on a high plateau in the French Alps, where Jews streamed in, where they were hidden, transported over the Swiss border, where all sorts of marginalized persons found shelter, clothing, food in those dark, dark days. He led his village into terrible danger, the threat of massacre at any time because of their resistance. André Trocmé did not just try to avoid trouble. He was very clear in the stand that he took and the stand that the village took. It was non-resistance. Non-violent resistance to the French regime, which was a puppet government, and to the Nazi policies of terrible extermination. At great risk, the village took its stand, founded a school, housed all sorts of immigrant children, ending up himself in an internment camp where there were communists who were hoping for the overthrow of both the French Vichy government and Germany, hoping for the victory of communism worldwide. He was laughed at and scorned until finally they saw the integrity of the person. They saw this total commitment to nonviolent resistance. Trocmé, this powerful man, did not like the word pacifist because of its nuance of passivity. He felt the most dangerous people in the world were those who simply stood aside and allowed evil to happen. His was an active engagement. It was an active, dangerous, and costly engagement with the forces of evil, but always nonviolently. For he had been conquered by the Spirit of Jesus. And the story is not without its tragedy and not without its great loss. And yet it is a story of great heroism and spiritual power and strength. And that city, that little village, saved thousands of lives. Going contrary to what was wise for them in terms of their own safety and well-being. Philip Haley, who was succumbing to the coercion of despair, when he read a reference to Le Chambon, ceased his research and he went there and he sought out the people 30 years later. And he wrote the account, "Lest innocent blood be shed," and thereby found in his own passionate search some ground of hope, because he found an instance where goodness happened, because there was an André Trocmé who determined at great risk and heavy cost that he would do no harm. And today, Today we are those, at least some of us, are old enough to remember the euphoria of victory in World War II, VE Day, VJ Day, and then the onset of the Cold War and that terrible ideological impasse maintained by the threat of nuclear holocaust, only to see in the late 80s the Berlin Wall go down and once again a kind of euphoria and a hope that maybe this would be the occasion for a new world order, only to find the decade of the 90s continuing to be instance after instance of violence and war and devastation. And as we worship today, we are a nation at war. I asked you last week, if you were to join the president and his cabinet last Lord's Day, how would you vote? Would you vote to go to war or not? We noted the fact that it is a terribly complex issue. Andre Trockmay was no naive idealist. He knew the complexity of it. In 1939, because of his fluent German, he actually considered whether or not he ought to infiltrate Hitler's entourage in order to assassinate him and to stave off the horror that was on the horizon. Trockmay said no, for it would separate me from the spirit of Jesus. Bonhoeffer, likewise, brilliant, committed, dedicated, likewise convinced that Jesus was essentially a pacifist and that the way of Jesus was the way of nonviolence, made his decision the other way. He, against everything in him, joined that group to assassinate Hitler, taking violence in his hands against his will. It's very complex. It's not a simple matter. Here were two absolutely dedicated disciples of Jesus Christ, convinced of Jesus' way of nonviolent protest, of resistance against all evil nonviolently. One, creating a city of refuge. The other, moving toward assassination, which backfired, which ended up in his martyrdom. And here we are. How would you have voted last Sunday? How do you vote now? The bombs, the rockets rain on Kosovo, Yugoslavia. The threat and the peril is very great. For ostensibly humanitarian reasons, we use violence. And we have seen that it raises the ante, stiffens the resistance, and brings in its wake greater violence, which causes our thinking heads to wonder whether or not we'll have to go the next step, which all for political reasons say absolutely not, but which we all know could happen next week. Because violence always begets violence. And our violence this past week may be, possibly, the right choice, maybe not, has put us in and our world in greater peril even than a week ago when Trockmay was in an internment camp with the communists who were scorning him initially It was announced that the Germans had been defeated at Stalingrad, and the communists rejoiced, and Trotsky didn't rejoice. And he was asked, would you have thought that the Russians should simply have lain down and let the Germans run over them? Non-violent resistance? And he said, no, it was too late. He was no naive idealist that didn't know of the reality of darkness and evil in this world, and as I said before, the complexity of it all. He said, you have to lay the groundwork for non-violent resistance. You have to prepare the way. It takes a long, long time and the cultivation of a whole different spirit. We live in a world that is filled with darkness. I don't know if we should have started this week or not. In the wake of it, I have my doubts. Because finally, we are dealing with a human problem that violence cannot solve. Violence can coerce and hold at bay, but violence will never transform the human spirit nor human society. And so, here we are. We are at war. Is there no hope? Is it deja vu forever? I find at least this ray of hope. I find that we are not uncritically receiving the spin doctors of the Pentagon and the administration anymore, are we? I hope that I don't go over the line into cynicism. But frankly, I know now I cannot believe my own government reports on what's really happening or why what is happening is happening. And I hope that spirit of self-criticism permeates the whole nation so that we ask the tough questions and refuse to be sheep led to the slaughter by the propaganda mill that has all kinds of political motivations and economic involvement. I hope we know now that the nonviolent protest against the world as it was that we see in Jesus is a nonviolent protest that all of us must embody as we question those in authority, as we test. And then I find at least a ray of hope also in the fact that here and there when, for example, one of our pilots is interviewed, I don't see him raging, foaming at the mouth, ready to go. I see a question. There was a young man who was launching the rockets from a ship who was interviewed, who said, I hope we're doing the right thing. And I hope that those deep questions permeate the depths of our whole military from the Pentagon on down. Doesn't make for a very good fighting force, folks. But the only hope we have is that somewhere in the world there are enough people, sometime or other, a critical mass that will say enough. Violence only leads to violence. And there's got to be another way. On this Palm Sunday, 1999, it's like Jesus and Jerusalem all over again. If only today you knew the things that make for peace. But they are hid from your eyes. There is a line crossed over that leads to the abyss of darkness. And I want to suggest that Jesus was not an impossibly idealistic embodied ethical principle. I want to suggest that Jesus is the only hope of the world, the most practical politics this world has ever heard.